When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Hey, welcome back to this week's episode of the Elise Glink Show. I'm Elise Glink, and I am here to help you make the smartest decisions you can about your financial life. But first, here's my Glinkonomics report. So some of you may have noticed that the stock market is, let's say, a little indecisive. Little up, a little down, a lot down. Investors couldn't seem to make sense of the economic problems in China and how severe they actually are. While the sell-off early in the week was a bit of a stomach-churner, things were sort of back on track, up and down, by Friday, and the market somehow managed to post a gain overall. This week is an entirely different story. So we saw the stock market dive nearly 400 points yesterday, and it's just crazy up and down this week. That's a lot of volatility. In fact, the volatility indexes have been kind of off the charts. And market volatility can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. To savvy investors, it can mean tremendous opportunity. To retirees watching their investments tank, knowing that they're getting far less than 1% on their savings, can mean a trip to the cardiologist. Now, people often ask me if I think the stock market is a safe place for money or whether I believe real estate is a better investment. So, obviously, neither is completely safe, right? There's risk involved everywhere, and with risk comes reward, but it also means you can lose money. We've seen both the housing market and the stock market bubble crash and burn in the last couple of decades particularly. Here's the good news. When you invest for the long run, your investments are going to be a lot more likely to bear fruit. And sure, there are still plenty of opportunities to lose your shirt, like if you owned a lot of Lehman Brothers stock, for example, or if you bought a house in the Ninth Ward of New Orleans. But when you allow your investing timeline to stretch out over the longer term, you're much more likely to see gains than if you're trying to time the market. In fact, let me just be really clear. Timing the market never works, so don't do it. Day traders go broke, most of them anyway. So no matter where you choose to put your money, you should remember that the best investment is one that you can afford to hold on to for a really long time. And when I say long time, I don't mean 2 years. I mean something on the order of 7 to 20 years. That's a long time horizon for the stock market. Okay, let's go on to the rest of the show. I'm super excited to have Doug Duncan as my guest this week. Doug is the chief economist at Fannie Mae. And Fannie Mae, as you all know, is the market leader for the secondary mortgage market. I've known Doug for, I don't know, a long time. And Fannie Mae just released its monthly housing and economic outlook for August 2015. Coming on the heels of all the interesting economic news I just mentioned, plus the deal with Greece, I think this is a great time to hear from him about what he's seeing in the U.S. economy as a whole, and in the housing sector in particular. After my conversation with Doug, I want to take a few minutes to jump back into the rent versus buy debate. And more specifically, I have four sets of hypothetical circumstances that I think are especially conducive to home buying. So if you can identify with any of these, I want you to give serious consideration to buying a home in the near future before interest rates go up. So if you're on the home buying fence, I suggest you stay tuned. Then I'd like to do a little debunking of a reason that I've heard people use to justify a home purchase that I frankly do not agree with. Saving money on your taxes by deducting your mortgage payment is a great deal if you qualify. It is not enough on its own to justify buying a home. I'm going to explain why in the final segment. All right, that's the lineup for today's show. Let's get started. Fannie Mae just published its monthly housing and economic outlook for August, now that we're in September, and it includes a bit of a cautionary note about the flat second quarter growth we saw in the economy. That doesn't seem to have affected Fannie Mae's prediction for the year's growth overall, And with regards to housing in particular, the outlook remains pretty optimistic. The report takes note of strong home price appreciation and tight inventory controls, which are great for homeowners, not so good for first-time homebuyers. So I'm excited to have Fannie Mae's chief economist, Doug Duncan, on the phone with me today to talk about the latest data. And who knows, maybe we'll even talk a little bit about the stock market craziness. Welcome to the show, Doug.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So the world over the last couple of weeks, if you just look at the stock market, you'd think that we were heading for some sort of 2008 all over again. And yet, federal government's numbers made the first quarter look pretty terrific and essentially offset what we saw was quasi-negative, maybe down a little bit or up a little bit or maybe just flat growth in Q1. And in Q2, we see it zooming ahead. So what's your take on that?
Yeah, there's no question the first half ended up being reasonable. And we think the second half will be pretty similar to the first half. So it's growth. That's good news. The underlying best part of that story is continued strong job growth, which, of course, in the housing industry, that's something we focus on a lot. We're hoping to see real income growth pick up. That's the other leg that has to get put in place before you'll start to see a really robust housing market. Nonetheless, housing is actually doing pretty well in the midst of this. We're not back to normal. You referenced a couple of points that we can talk about in terms of supply and the strength of house price growth, but not bad.
Well, that's so lukewarm. I've heard you, listen, over the years, I've heard you be really gung-ho about growth. And first of all, we should just
probably an adjustment of expectations, right? I mean, we haven't normally, when you come out of a recession, particularly a severe recession, you see real strong growth for a couple of years, well above long-term averages, and we never saw that.
No.
So we're really still below a mark where we should be.
Well, the numbers this year for new construction look still like they're going to be about 500,000, which is roughly half of where it should be. Wouldn't you agree? That's kind of not good, right?
Yeah, the big story in the housing market in general is the lack of supply growth for single family homes. The apartment market is doing quite well, and construction there has ramped up, as you would expect to see after the kind of a downturn that we had, and it will probably continue to be strong for a while. But the real missing element is the supply of single family properties, particularly at the lower and middle price points. So part of the reason you're seeing what is very strong real house price growth is the lack of supply. Even though the demand side of the equation isn't going gangbusters, it's growing, but given the pace at which it's growing, you would expect to see actually a lower real house price growth.
So there's more profit in the higher end stuff. And we're seeing builders, sort of the mom and pop builders who were a mainstay of creating that kind of low to moderate income new housing product, let's call it. A lot of them lost their companies in the recession. The land went back to the builders turned around. We actually saw two of the biggest new construction companies, Pulte and who did they merge with? Centex, right? Mm-hmm. They merged. And now you've got Toll Brothers focusing on very high-end stuff. You've got the remaining home builders focusing on where the profit is. But you're also, to your point about unemployment, there's just so many people left the house creation market. I'm hearing from builders and from other economists that it's very, very difficult for people to find people who actually know how to do drywall, moldings, painting, and getting them in any kind of steady supply is tough for them as well. And they, when you can find them, they want a lot of money for the job.
Yeah, I asked Bill at the National Federation, Bill Dunkelberg at the National Federation of Independent Business, to take a look at his survey of small construction businesses over the last 20 years or so, and ask what's the average share of them that say they have a hard time finding workers. And he said it's about 5%. So I asked him, what's the share today that's saying that? And he said it's 21%. So that's one piece of evidence. Your point on wages, if you look at the federal data on real wages in construction, they're roughly at the same level they were at the peak of the boom. So clearly the market is signaling for that there is strong demand for construction labor and it can't be identified. A second factor that we're investigating, I don't know the fact of this yet, but some of those small contractors have historically done one of two things. Either they've taken lines of credit under the acquisition, development, and construction loan type from their local bank, or they've tapped equity in their home for working capital for their building activities, for speculative building. The regulators have clamped down on ADC lending because of the losses that occurred in the crisis. And in many instances, it may be the case that some of those smaller contractors saw their house price fall and can't tap equity in their home either. So credit could be an issue. And then the third issue is simply the availability and difficulty of permitting land. It seems as though across the country, one of the responses to the crisis was a sort of systematic tightening of regulation related to the development of residential real estate properties.
Well, permitting has always been tough, and I think there's a lot of not in my backyard NIMBY sort of activity that goes on, and people have gotten, you know, very aggressive in that. And then you've got on the West Coast a whole lot of community stuff going on where people are tattling on their neighbors for water usage and things like that. It's mm-hmm. not exactly so friendly for growth. So, Doug, let's talk for a minute about Fannie Mae's full-year growth outlook. You've got it unchanged at 2.1%. It's interesting. We were at basically zero growth in the first quarter. We had 3-plus percent growth second quarter and a revision look. Where do you think we're going in third and fourth quarter to get back to that 2% average level? Do you think we're going to go down, or do you think we're going to go up?
I think it'll be right at the 2 to 2.25% growth average in the second half. So that's why our forecast says, I think, 2.1% for the full year. So we'll be just a little bit above that. The first half was just a little bit below that. It's tepid growth. That's not the kind of growth that that generates a great deal of excitement economically. And to your point about housing, yeah, it's better, but a demographically appropriate level of total housing starts would be about 1.5 million. We might be at 1.15 million. Mm-hmm. So we're still a ways away from normal, if that would be your measure of how we get to normal. Nonetheless, housing will contribute more this year than it has contributed each of the past years since the recovery started. So it's on the right path, but we still have a ways to go.
All right. And then finally, the stock market down about 300-400 points today. We've seen really just getting hammered by China, you know, day in and day out. So let's, if you don't mind, let's talk for a moment about China. And China's where so much manufacturing is going on now for the U.S. housing industry, although I don't know after what happened with drywall, if we'll be buying so much Chinese drywall. But what's your perspective sort of on China, Greece, and this kind of global unease that seems to be settling over the economic world or from an economic perspective, and how you think that might affect us going forward over the next year?
Well, there's no question that China's economic growth is slowing. The question related to that is how much. Nobody really knows for sure. It's difficult to understand just how accurate their economic reporting is. But you can tell by looking at the commodity prices around the globe that they are slowing because they were the marginal buyer in almost every commodity market. And we've seen them slow systematically. So that is having an impact on those particular intensive and where they were selling commodities to China for its infrastructure and internal investment development. China's made no bones about the fact that they ultimately have to rebalance between investment and consumption, but that's not an easy task, and particularly in a command economy. Theirs is not a market economy in the sense that ours is. They've moved somewhat in that direction. But as you can see in their reactions to the turmoil in their stock market in the last month or so, it's a very different thing to try to generate stability in a managed market as opposed to a market-oriented economy. In Greece, essentially, they've kicked the can down the road another 3 years or so. So that, in the near term, is not going to be a big story. The question is whether or not the EU in general will, with their quantitative easing, start to see some growth, we will await that. From the U.S. perspective, our biggest trading partners are Canada and Mexico, and both of them are doing okay. Canada is suffering from the decline in oil prices, so that's actually slowing them more than it's slowing us, although it has had somewhat of a tamping down effect on us through the investment side of things. Mexico is doing fine. And the amount of trade we actually do as a share of our total trade with China is pretty small. I think I saw most recent numbers, something on the order of 6%. So it's actually quite small, even though it gets a lot of coverage. They're a larger, more important trading partner in Southeast Asia. Those countries are likely to suffer more from the slowdown of China than we are, and also places like Brazil, which are resource intensive.
And all the rest. All right. Well, Doug, thank you so much for joining me today. That's, as always, really enlightening. Doug Duncan is chief economist for Fannie Mae.
Thank you. Glad to be there.
There are times when it makes sense to rent, even with interest rates historically low like they are now. And as I've said before, buying a house should be at least a 5 to 10 year commitment. Otherwise, it simply doesn't make financial sense. But if you find yourself in one of the four situations I'm about to describe, you might want to give extra consideration to buying now before interest rates rise any higher. I'm Elise Glink. Here's today's Daily Update. First and most importantly, buy a home if you really want to own a home and if you're ready to take on that responsibility. And if you found the neighborhood you want to live in and believing that owning there will be better for you and your family than renting, then you're a great candidate for homeownership. Second, buy where you can add value, either by fixing up a property and then living there for a while, or by maintaining the property while it appreciates in value because the neighborhood is improving. Owning real estate isn't cheap, but if you choose wisely, you may even find you're starting on a part-time career path as a real estate investor. Watch out. Third, you should buy if you found an amazing deal in a foreclosure or a short sale. Now, there aren't as many distressed properties in the market as there used to be, and they cost more money. But there are certain parts of the country where foreclosures are downright common. Finally, you should buy a home if you really want to control your own domain. While you might not be able to control certain expenses, you could lock in an interest rate for 30 years and then satisfy your desire to own a home. Build in equity with it and not be subject to yearly rent increases by a landlord. Oh, and then there's this whole thing where if you really want to paint it black and yellow, you can. I sometimes hear from people who are considering buying a home simply for the tax benefits that they think they'll receive from deducting their mortgage payments. No, but taxes are just one expense to consider when buying a home, certainly not the reason to actually do it. To make a fair comparison between owning and renting, you have to always do the math. And for the math challenged, feel free to let TurboTax or MacinTax or some other sort of tax program do the heavy lifting. First, copy your tax information from last year to a new file. In that new file, you have to add in what you would expect to pay in real estate taxes and what you would pay in the interest on your loan. Not the total mortgage amount, just the loan, the interest on the loan. Now, compare what you paid in taxes last year with what you would have paid or what you would be paying had you owned a home. Okay, you're not done yet. To make a really fair comparison, you need to factor in the cost of owning a home versus the cost to rent a similar home. And when you rent, you generally pay your utility expenses, renter's insurance, and the rent itself. When you own, you'll have the same utility expenses, and you'll have maintenance expenses, real estate taxes, homeowner's insurance, and interest on your loan. And if you happen to be renting, owning a condo, there's also condo fees. Now, don't forget there are expenses associated with the purchase and sale of property, including title and escrow company charges, lender fees, transfer taxes, municipal expenses, the commission you'll pay to the broker, and others. And a lot of these are just one-time fees, but they certainly will add to the overall cost of buying and selling your property. Only once that you've assembled all this information will you truly be able to make a fair comparison between what it costs you to live in your rental and what it would cost you to purchase a home. One place you might want to spend a little time is at the New York Times website, where they have a pretty decent technology tool, I don't even know what you want to call it, calculator maybe, that will help you examine most of the costs between owning and renting. I hope you enjoyed today's episode, and a big thank you to Doug Duncan, Chief Economist for Fannie Mae, for his insights in the market and what it's going to take, actually, to get the housing market going again. If there's anything you missed, don't worry. You can find the show notes to this episode at thinklink.com, thinkglink.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes if you haven't yet already, and please consider giving the show a rating or a review while you're there. You can do so by searching for the Elise Glink Show in the podcast section of iTunes, or just Google Elise Glink Show iTunes and then hit enter. Leaving a review will help us get found by other people. I also would love for you to check out my other podcast, Monday Morning Marketing with Elise Glink and John Byrne, for some extra marketing, PR, and social media advice. We cover the gamut of things, and I think they're pretty interesting topics. So you can find it on iTunes as well, or you can Google it, or in the blog section of my digital content agency website, thinklinkmedia.com. That's the end of another episode of The Elise Glink Show. I'm still your host, Elise Glink, and I'll be back next week with another new episode. In the meantime, have a great Labor Day, and thanks for listening, everybody.